Yes, I'm actually going to present on my experience, which I started in this process in 2006 during the pilot stage. I'm going to break this up into really four segments. The first one with the pilot, the second one during the time when we developed our training, and then the revisions that we made during that time, and the recommendations. So early in this process, I actually was brand new DIS at the time, and that picture that was shown with the syphilis cluster, that was really my first time with having any experience with the internet. I had none before that. And people were just naming all these screen names and email addresses. I just, you know, was lucky enough to have a supervisor that really pushed for me to be able to go online at that time, and I was lucky that the expansion took place in my area. But at the same time, I really didn't know what I was doing. And it was definitely a learn as you go. I quickly discovered that I really needed national guidance. And I was constantly online looking for what other states are doing this and who else has ever done this before. I wished at the time that I knew Stefan better and that I knew him, because not only did I want to know how to do this and talk about it in interviews, but I really needed information on just some of the technical aspects of being online. I knew I needed training, and the biggest thing for me during this time was having my supervisor allow me time to spend online to do this. During our pilot, we went through many revisions, and some of these, looking back, we laugh at now, but we started out with our email messages would all be in caps, because it was thought at that time, this will really stand out in someone's inbox. So we said, urgent health message, respond immediately. We had some success. And then we changed it a little bit to say, well, you know, we don't want to sound that crazy. So urgent health message, respond at once, because we really wanted them to respond as soon as they saw the message. This one was written in our pilot, and I have to admit, I never used this. This is one that I used to laugh at. Urgent health matter, this is no joke. And after that time, we stopped using caps and things, but we went to three attempts per person, and if it needed to be. And it was urgent health matter, read and respond, because really that's what we wanted them to do, read the message and respond to us. And then we would change it slightly, important health message, read and respond. Our original pilot notification email, again, read like this. The things that you're going to see, and I'm going to show you our progression as time went on, things that we ended up changing. But, of course, we said, you know, urgent health message, respond immediately. We always would say hello, whatever the screen name was, because that normally was all that we knew about the person. And basically tell them who we are and that this is an important health matter. So it was very general, kind of like a note that would be left at a door. These were the things that people commented back to me, and this was over a period of time. The ones that did respond, eventually. They would just either respond to me online and say, how do I know that this is real? How do I know you are with the health department? How do I know that this isn't spam? And other people would tell me, well, your first two times that you sent me a message went right into my spam box. And other people would get really angry with me and say, I don't answer things that are in caps, you know. And this was all a learning process for me as well. And I had to think about, boy, do I even open messages at home that I don't know who they're from? Well, I don't. So, you know, people would also respond via the message still online and say, you know, I just want to know what this is about. Just tell me what it is. What is the health matter? And so confidentiality was always an issue. It was an issue of how do you know as the worker that the person you're sending the message to is the right person? What if people share email addresses? What if it's on a chat site or it's an instant message and it's up on their computer? How do you know who else is standing behind that person? And all these things were talked about constantly, and it was really finding balance with that. We talked about how much is too much information to put in a message or not enough information based on people's responses. And how can we ensure, and how could I ensure as the worker to know if that person opened my message or not? And in our messages or in the instant message, how can I motivate this person to actually call me and talk to me with the language that we had to use? And so these were questions that I asked during this process. Initially, what websites should I really be on? Obviously, if this website was named as a venue that people were meeting, that was kind of a no-brainer, but should I be on other websites? Hearing about all this, you know, the popularity of social networking sites, and should I be on those as well? You know, what should I do? Once I'm on, how do I verify that, again, that's the right person? You know, sometimes I would have issues happen where they would name a screen name, but there was many, many screen names that were very close to that, and the picture didn't match necessarily the description. And how do I know my message was read again? And how do I respond online when that person responded to me? Because quite honestly, during our pilot stage, we didn't have a script for that. There's so many different things that can happen, and sometimes it was difficult to know how to respond. So again, these were more questions that I had. You know, how many messages can I send? How many attempts per person should be made? You know, I don't want to harass people online either. And when will I know to send that second or third message? Because it was determined that three messages per person, three attempts per person was what we were going to do. And again, this was a whole new avenue of DIS work. When that person actually does call me, what do I say? I don't know really anything about this person. I know their screen name. I might have a description. I might not even know where they live. I don't know their birthday. I don't know their name. How am I going to help this person, and how am I going to not let them know what I don't know about them? So the challenges were as far as messages being read, and this took time for me to learn, was every website and every email program, they have different options whether or not we can tell whether the message was opened or read. If we sent messages through our own Department of Health email, we would always send it as a return receipt. That was the way that we wanted to do it. And we only really knew that those messages weren't opened when they didn't get returned to us. But that really didn't account for if those messages went into someone's spam box or not. So we had some success with that, but not completely. And then, of course, there are some sites that we used, that like Adam for Adam and MySpace, where you can tell if the message was open and read. So that was helpful. But so many of the other sites, they don't show that. So that's a challenge. This is a big one that I just wanted to talk about a little bit for supervisors and people that are looking to do this. Again, I was lucky that I had someone that allowed me to do this work early on, and it took me a lot of time to learn. But I do have coworkers, and at the time, coworkers that had been a field worker for 30 plus years. And, you know, the attitude was, you are a field worker. Why are you sitting behind the computer? And I knew I was hired as a field worker. And early on, I was in the field much more. And it bothered me. I felt like I wasn't being a good worker, or that they were judging me, even though they weren't, you know, in a way I felt that. Another thing that I really struggled with was how to disposition these cases that didn't fit with what I knew traditionally, and everything that was on our traditional disposition codes didn't seem to match. I worried about the dispos that I was getting. They were not good as far as you know, what we aim for A's and C's, and my dispos were bad during this time, and I worried about that as far as my stats went. And the last thing is, you know, being online and seeing the images and the graphics and, you know, all the things that I would see on these websites, which was very new to me, was so much different than just talking to someone about these things. And so I really had to learn how to do that. And it did take time. You know, I was taken back at first, I'll admit that. So our data during this time, as Judy mentioned, we really had early success, which is why I think this grew. We had 170 internet-based investigations during this time period. 46% were partners to STD and 54% to HIV. And the findings were based on our early pilot when we just had our traditional disposition codes, and I call it the learn-as-you-go approach. 21%, which I thought was pretty good, of HIV partners were notified of the exposure, and we were able to learn their complete traditional information. 18% of the STD partners had an A or C disposition, which, you know, that was great for us because that's what we were going for. But 60% of these internet cases were dispoed with a J, an H, a K out of jurisdiction, or an L. And an L is, you know, other. So so many of them at this time, I didn't really know how to dispo them. And sometimes I'd give it a J, and sometimes an H, and sometimes an L. And it was really uncomfortable because they didn't always match what the work that went into doing what I was doing. So lessons learned. This is definitely very different from traditional partner services. It took a long time to learn the different websites and the venues and the things, but it was definitely necessary to learn each site. Again, confidentiality and privacy is always talked about on these different websites, and they're different. MySpace, maybe mom or dad has access to that young person's profile and can get into their email. Maybe other sites, it's just that person that's the only person's password protected can open that email message. So it's different, and we had to talk about that. And we really had to talk about what are the best ways that we can do this work better. And for me, I gotta be honest, it was asking the people who did respond, or even if it took them two or three times to respond to me, why did you respond? Why didn't you respond? And help us to be able to help people like you. And that was where I did a lot of my learning. So revision. Our IPS development guidelines was made, like Judy mentioned, it was through our pilot program and the experience. The national guidelines, which were being written, I think they were first released in 2007 as a draft, and I went through those every single day and read through them. But those were used, and feedback from the patients and the partners. And of course, Stefan, I can't say enough about how much he's helped us through the technical aspect. So the key changes that we made from our pilot, and again, these are things that still change, you know, as needed. But we decided, and it was through national guidelines suggested and from other areas, that instead of using all those series of subject lines, we don't have any subject line in our messages. We've created new message content for our emails, our initial emails. We can inform of disease-specific information during email messages. We created new IPS IPS dispositions so that it can better reflect the work that we're doing. And we can capture, so for people like me who worry about our stats, we can capture what happens when it is an internet case into STD-MIS. So here's some of the revised things that we made. So our first attempt, okay, in yellow, it's left blank, our subject line. We decided that it wouldn't be really ideal to use a person's screen name if that's all we knew. So if it was Superman was the screen name, we wouldn't say, "Hello, Superman," because it's really telling the person that's really all we know about you. So if we didn't know it, we're just going to say hello. If we did know this person's name was Jim, then hello, Jim. We reworked these messages a few times, which is why you see the crossed out words. We ended up letting the person know exactly that they've been exposed, because that was an issue that was brought up by people. They just want to know what this is. So we're contacting you because someone you met, which we ended up changing, was recently changed that, but diagnosed with a laboratory confirmed infection. So we're telling them about an exposure. Let them know how they can reach us, but then we also addressed another issue about authenticity, that we really are with health department, and they can even check on us if they need to. So that really was helpful to make those changes. If a person does not want to actually call us, and they're just not going to, and we know they're not going to call us, and we're, you know, having our responses just online, if they give us permission, we call it a positive response, that we can give them the disease-specific information via the internet. And so this is an example of that message that I wrote to you because someone you were exposed to was diagnosed with laboratory-confirmed syphilis. That's an example. We give them information on where they can find out more information about that disease, and, you know, still hoping that they're going to call us and give our information. And I do have to tell you, I've only used this a few times because people normally will respond on our first attempts. But when I do use this, thinking, well, at least they know what it is, they end up calling. So it's been helpful. So here's just an example, and I know you have a green sheet. Those of you, hopefully everyone got some of our information here. We changed our have revised and revised and revised our internet dispositions. This is actually newly revised just in this month. But what we decided was the H disposition, traditional disposition, which is unable to locate. If the person was named as a internet-only partner with an email address or a screen name, that is enough information to locate. So we have a disposition if we can't locate that screen name with our internet disposition code. So we removed L for internet cases. And the series of L1, L2, L3, they're really to show our attempts so we can better know now with our data, how many attempts did it take us to get through to this person? How many attempts, you know, how many people replied on the second attempt? And that really helps us to know, do we need to change our messages? Are our messages working? In the L4, we don't have four attempts, but the L4 really represents all the different scenarios that can happen when the person wasn't notified. So moving forward, because it needed to be more than just me doing this, like Judy mentioned, we selected each region would have a staff person that would, my microphone stopped working. I'll just talk if you guys, can you hear me? Okay, so each staff person across the state in each region were selected. We did a pre-training survey to see what the needs were in the areas and among supervisors. And we created a module, sorry, Stefan, with how to do this work for the staff. So some of the survey questions, and if you guys want to know more about this, I have these available. But we asked just a lot of general questions about internet use among supervisors and the staff selected, just so we had an idea of what people knew or didn't know heading into the training. One of the things I do want to mention on this is we did ask the question about comfort level viewing sexually explicit images. Staff were selected by their supervisors to do this, and the survey that we did was anonymous. And I was surprised, and I think we were all surprised, that we had several people, they may have been supervisors or the selected staff, that did respond saying they were going to have a difficult time if they had to view these images. And quite frankly, some of them responded in a way that, wow, I can't believe that you can do this work and say what you said right there. But we had to address it. And so Peter, his piece of the cultural sensitivity and MSM training really played a large role in our training. So our first training for new staff was a 1.5 day training. And again, the pre-training survey really helped us develop what we were going to talk about it. In it. We did an overview, a general overview of websites, because the experience level was so different among supervisors and some of the staff that we had to really start from basic internet 101 kind of stuff. To the cultural sensitivity, at that time we had each region was given from Manhunt a profile for the region. So we were able to go on, teach everyone how to set up their profile on Manhunt. And from that, we practiced with each other, emailing and IMing and things like that from our Manhunt profile, so people could get an experience with what that was like. So the factors that helped with this training were everyone had a computer with unrestricted online access. Again, we went through those website venues. People had a module to follow of how to know how to send messages, and so we practiced those email messages and learning how to IM and email. As a result of having everyone trained, now new staff across the state, we decided that it would be helpful if we had support that, you know, people for starting out doing this. There's so many questions I know I had and I continue to have, and people would hear different things across the state than maybe I would in Syracuse. So we met on a conference call once a week, all the IPS staff and their supervisors, and we just talked about our cases and, you know, what are you hearing about and what websites and what issues are you having signing on and all these kinds of things, and it was awesome. And it really helped us all out. It also helped us to make sure that we're all doing things the same way, which is very important, because if, you know, I'm doing it one way here and someone's doing this, you know, trying to do the same thing, but they're, you know, not quite on the same page, it's not going to look good for us as a state. As a result of these calls, we ended up scaling them back to once a month, which we do currently. But as a result, we also were talking about, what do we do with out-of-jurisdiction cases, which is often talked about, and what if it's an out-of-state case, and we still want to help that person, but this state doesn't have the capacity to do this, so what do we do? And we just got talking about on a national level, and actually this is where the national IPS group idea came out of, which is awesome, and I hope all you guys will join that as well, if you already aren't. So our data from 2008, we had 129 internet-based investigations. The majority of them were partners to STD, and 22% of these STD cases were ARC dispoed, which was a 57% increase since our pilot, so that was awesome. And again, I said 60% of the cases during the pilot program were those J's, HK's, or just the traditional L dispositions. But since we changed our messages and we have new outcomes for IPS cases, we only had 2% during this time dispoed like that. So we thought that was pretty successful. So fine-tuning our program here. Again, this took us a long, long time to actually release our guidelines. And last February, we did in 2009. We made several revisions along the way, and we try, you know, messages and say, well, we need to take that wording out of "you met this person," because we don't want to tell a person they met someone online. You know, maybe they did, but we're kind of outing the person who named them if we use that language. So we revised these several times. But as we revised them and as people were trained to do this, we needed new training and new backup staff, because at this time, supervisors really shouldn't have been their job to be the backup person. So another staff person in each region was going to be trained as a backup. So these were the reasons that we needed new training. We needed to clarify issues that had come up, like out of jurisdiction. We added that HIV partner notification could be done online, and so that was a big issue for us, because it's never anything that we could do before on the phone or anything. So staff had trouble with that, but needed to have guidance with how to do that. And of course, the cultural competency is always ongoing, and we need to know what we're doing, and each site is different, and so the training just needed to happen. So our outline for our 2009 training was, we revised our manual, our IPS manual. We really got into more of not only just using the internet to find these people, but how do we get them named in the first place? What are we asking in our interviews? And so talking about better interviewing techniques. Always is a challenge is how to dispo these cases, because they don't always fit. So we talked about that and review. And how do you just, like Judy mentioned, how to use the internet to just help in all cases is record searching and search tools. And we did a lot of live mock communication and provided everyone with feedback. So again, the manual that we released, it has our guidelines, protocol, tests and standards, a lot of forms in there of how we do this, all our sample messages, tools that were help in success, a lot of the national tools that came out of our NIPS group, and resources for, you know, if we have just technical assistance help, you know, who to ask for that. And so this was really one of the fun things that I had done putting together. I wanted to have everyone know from beginning to end how to work these kind of cases and what I wish that I had back in the pilot stage. But interviewing a patient, so we had role plays where one person had to play the DIS and the other person was the patient, and they had scripts just like ISTDI and ASTDI, but the goal was to get the person to elicit internet partners and to ask those type of questions. Once those people were elicited, we used those pretend people, and we had to look for them online. And before the training, I went on and I created pretend profiles of these pretend people. So that's kind of fun. And so, you know, it was kind of a challenge in our training, and people found these pretend profiles. And then we actually, as a group, we contacted these people during the training. And so we had experience of how to email them, and we had a couple people pretend to be the really difficult patient or partner, and what it would look like. So people had experience knowing these are responses that, you know, can happen, and how are you going to respond to that? How are you going to respond once the person calls and things like that, and how to dispo and close a case? So again, the successes for this training, of course, were the computers, the hands-on activities, the manual, the overview of all the lessons that have been learned. But we included other people in our training. This time we had our training staff come, our data staff, so everyone really was on the same page. Educators and AIDS Institute staff, as well as we invited some an HIV test counselor to come on board just to hear also. So one thing that has been learned is that the internet really can improve the outcome on all cases. And this is something that I try to do, is I just assume that everyone is online. I just assume it because it's so popular. Maybe they're not online to meet partners, but people probably are online in one way or another. So during the interviews, not just ask about online usage or where a person met, but, you know, just talk, you know, in general terms about the internet, you know, Facebook, MySpace, the things that are less threatening. And normalize the fact that the health department, we're very successful in finding people online. So if we do learn just minimal information on any person, to tell that patient that we, you know, really can find people online very easily. So do you think they might have a Facebook page or a MySpace? And you'd be surprised if people just, oh, yeah. Oh, you guys are on there? Oh, okay, yeah, I can do that. So some of the things that have helped along the way with our data is we've created a statewide screening database, an email database. And what we can do is we can record search it to see if this person's screen name or email has ever come up before. We have logs that we hand in once a month, but we each region, and it documents kind of how many attempts it's taking us. So we have a real clear way to view case by case what's happening month by month, and it's easier for our data staff. Again, our IPS dispositions, better data, it helps us know, you know, really what we're doing, and those of us that are doing the work, it really shows more of the time and the effort that's put in. One of the things that we do, because oftentimes we learn from beginning to end that this person now is this traditional person. We've learned everything about them, which is the goal. But to know that when we hand in our paperwork on our field records, we write code internet on it to show that this, the reason that we know this information was because of the internet. So this is an example of our IPS database. Screen names, again, are entered in here. As much information that's learned about the person is entered. There isn't any information about disease-specific information, so for confidentiality reasons, but it does link to field record numbers and interview record numbers. So in 2009, we had 162 internet-based investigations. The majority, again, are partners to STD. 17%, which has been about the norm, about 20% of the time we have ARC dispos. 62% had an internet code of an L, and 38% started as an internet case but converted to a traditional disposition, which was pretty big. So really there's kind of two ways to look at internet dispos. Really the one is having the case start as an internet case and then move to a traditional known outcome, and that again was 38%. And with our new internet dispositions, we know now because of the message that we have out and the message content, when we know that person read it, we now know that they've at least been notified of an exposure, which is great. And 66% of all of our cases in 2009 were at least notified of an exposure, and we know that. It's not, you know, unknown. So here are some recommendations. Staff really need to know, first of all, is this an IPS case or not? There's so much that you can find out online that you might not even need to send that email message out. You might learn all these other things to make it a traditional case before you even start. How am I doing with time? Okay. Staff need to learn the websites and the terms of service on the websites. I can't say this enough because every website is so different that what you can do on one, you might not be able to do on another one, and you can't just go blindly and just say, well, this is what my guidelines say I can do, and so I'm just going to do it this way. Every site is different. Keeping your supervisors informed, and this is strange, but it's, you know, for me, I know more about this than my supervisor. But I also, she's my supervisor, I need to tell her, you know, what I'm doing, what I'm, you know, if I have a question, just so we're all on the same page, and we need that guidance doing this. Documenting field records and IPS logs, how to send messages and when to send them, and how to close the case. So again, the goals for IPS is reaching partners through internet-only identifying information. That is the first reason why we even got started doing this. But also turning internet cases or limited information cases into traditional cases with the internet, and get people tested and treated who need it. So things that have helped me is IT departments, my local IT department, and having them help me with like the little things on site, but as well as with our remote server access. Guidelines need to be flexible, as I've showed you. We've changed them several times, but we do need guide. We do need a guide. Hands-on training, I can't say enough about it because it's different to just hear people talk about it than to actually do it. Cultural sensitivity, I can't tell you enough that that's very, very important, and you don't want to have the wrong person or someone who is uncomfortable, and really uncomfortable, out there representing us online. Professionalism, again, this is so important, and I've heard this at national meetings that, this is new and we want to do this correctly and we want to do it the right way, but we should talk to each other about it. Who else is doing this? And we don't want to mess things up for other areas, and be the one that, messed everything up on Facebook because we weren't paying attention to the rules. And so the having the conference calls and the things with our supervisors really is helpful for that. Again, cultural competency, I can't say this enough, but the feel and the cultures on the different sites themselves are something that needs to be known and worked on. MySpace, very different from Adam for Adam, and people need to know that the messages and the feel of that when you're on those sites, you need to be different. This is just an example of some of the sites that we have profiles on as the State Health Department. And again, they're very different. Some are social networking, some are sex-seeking sites, and the feel and the culture is very different, and they all have their own set of rules. This is an example of something I've learned throughout this process. And it's early on, I would have, if I had an email address named as the only identifier for a person, emailed the person, right? I have an email address, they need the information, I'll just email them. What I've learned through this process and all of the things that the internet can provide, it's really helped me because now I will take an email address and I'll Google it or plug it into other things that I know online. So this is just an example. The Google search shows me that it belongs to a name. I plug that name I learned into Facebook, and their Facebook page shows me their location. Well, I take that information I learned into the PIPL website. I can plug in location and name, and I learn a phone number and an address. And so now this case that started as just an email address, I don't even need to send them an email message. I can work them as a traditional case. But had I not known that and used those tools, I wouldn't be able to do that. And then closing, these are groups that were created throughout this process and on stdpreventiononline.org. If you guys aren't a member of that, I would suggest you be. It's been very helpful for us. We have a New York State Outreach Guidelines group, which Peter is going to talk about. We also have a group that was created for out-of-jurisdiction coordinators, so we can try to coordinate which project areas have IPS, which ones don't. We still need growth in that area. And again, the national IPS group was created out of our state conference calls, which has been fantastic. Some of the other resources that you can find on there for IPS work is they're great. And that's pretty much all I have to say.